Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to our first general session of the CCB Fall 2011 Convention. Now, I realize that we have people still kind of coming in, and so what I'm going to do before we get started with our program is, and if I didn't do this, I know I'd really get in trouble. So I'm going to give the microphone over to our treasurer, Peter Pardini, who wishes to make some brief announcements.
Thank you very much, Donna. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Fall 2011 Conference and Convention of the CCB. And basically, I want to remind people that we have, this year we have two exhibit rooms. They are the... Burgundy Bordeaux and the Colombard Moselle room. One of the rooms is across from the CCB registration desk, and the other one's right in the other, on the other hallway. So I'd really encourage everyone to please check out the both CCB exhibit rooms, because one of the rooms you can purchase Mutstrup T-shirts. Bags and doggy bandanas. The T-shirts are $10. The bags are $5. And the bandanas are $3. In addition to that, the BRLC, Brave Revival League of California, is selling fudge for $2 a bag. And also, the San Francisco chapter has radios for $15 each, and among other items. So you really need to please check out the exhibit area. Today they'll be open till 5. Tomorrow they start at 9 o'clock, and they'll be open till 4. But try to get there in the morning, because a lot of times when the business gets slow on Saturday afternoon, vendors decide to pack up a little early because they want to get home and enjoy the rest of their weekend. So I would encourage everyone to please check out the exhibit area. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, our treasurer, Peter Pardini. If we could please have, I know people are trying to get settled, but if we could please speak to each other if we have to in a very, very dull roar, whispers. And I'm also making the announcement, put your cell phones on vibrate or turn them off. I think all the rest of us don't need to know that you're getting a phone call. So, well, then just bring it on up here and I'll talk to him. Okay, so we are going to go ahead and start the program officially. And can we please get settled here? Okay. Thank you very much. Ken Metz in the background is seeking the floor, and the only reason I am giving him the floor is because he is, along with Etzenbarger from time to time, our ACB radio streaming crew, California style. All righty. Thank you, sir. Thank you, thank you. And I hear a bunch of folks talking here in the front row. And we need to go ahead and have some quiet or whispers, please. All right. For those who do not know, I am Donna Pomerantz, president of the California Council of the Blind, and I'm very pleased to be here and pleased that everyone else is here. There have just been people everywhere today, and I want to thank each and every one of you for coming. And I would like to go ahead and give the microphone over to Pastor, and I always want to say Fortier, but it's Fortier, amen, from the New Salvation Ministry Urban Street Church here in Los Angeles, California. Please welcome Pastor Fortier.
I'd like to say good afternoon to everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Pastor Gerald D. Fortier for New Salvation Ministries Urban Street Church here in South Central Los Angeles. And when Ken Metz asked me to come to do the invocation for the California Council of the Blind, I was so delighted. That's my very special friend, and we heard that. In any case, it's an honor to be here to do the invocation. You know, there's an old wise tale, and this is what it says. It says, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Anybody relate to that? Yeah. All right. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Let's make sure we're making a stand for what's right here today. Amen? Amen. There's a verse of scripture in Ecclesiastes, the third chapter, and it says, to everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. How many here know that we're under heaven right now? God predetermines the events of our life. Before you were born, God knew that you would be here today. Amen? Amen. There's another scripture in Galatians 6, and it says, and let us not grow weary in doing good, for in due season we shall reap a harvest of blessing if we what? If we don't give up. If we don't lose heart. So I want you to hang in there. Last but not least, I want to tell this little story, and then I'm going to pray. In the Bible, in St. John chapter 9, verse 1, it talks about a man that was born blind. Jesus, being the rabbi, teaching his disciples about spiritual matters, took this opportunity to teach them something about the kingdom of God. Now, what happened is this man was born blind, and his disciples asked Jesus, why was this man born blind? Was it because his mother sinned or because his father sinned? Jesus finally told him neither. He was born blind so that the works of God could be revealed today. You notice I said today. Understand this, there is something God is trying to reveal through this convention. Remember, God or the Holy Spirit is a gentleman. He won't force anything on you. So I'm asking you today to remain or keep a teachable spirit and keep an open mind about everything that's happening today and throughout this convention. Amen? Amen. Can we get a hand clap? Now, I'm going to pray. I would ask, please, that every head be bowed and every eye be closed. You notice I said every eye. Just a little joke. Before I pray, I want to say one more thing, too. In 1984, I want you to know that I was hit with a stray pellet in my left eye. And I'm completely blind on one side. So I want you to know that I'm not here just because Ken Metz invited me to come to do the invocation. It's because I can relate. And because I love you all. And I want you to know that I can do all things with your help and through Christ who strengthens me. Every head bowed, every eye closed. For Lord God in heaven, we thank you so much for this invocation. We thank you for this convention, Lord. We thank you for this time of coming together, Lord. We thank you for the California Council of the Blind, Lord. We thank you, Lord, for every opportunity there is to better ourselves, Lord, to educate ourselves, Lord, to understand about advocating for equal rights. Holy Spirit, we welcome you in the midst. I pray that you open up every heart, every mind, and every understanding that we may be able to receive what's due to us on today and throughout the rest of this convention. I thank you for every man and woman, and if there are any children, that's here today. Bless them and keep them. This is my prayer. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Okay, can everyone please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance? Okay. And talk about being live. Ken, did we have the color guard? Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you. Put your right hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay. I would like to know if Councilman Tom Labonte is in the room. Okay. Council member is, he mentioned that he would be possibly running late. City Council meets also today. So what I would like to do is go to the next item on our program. And Councilmember Labonge will absolutely, as Mitch said, let us know when he is here.
Not shy.
No, he's not shy. The next item on our program is trends impacting people who are blind, website accessibility, access to health care, and emerging issues on technology. Paula Perlman, Executive Director, Disability Rights Legal Center, Associate Visiting Professor of Law, Loyola Law School. And I would say she has an absolute wonderful I have her vita in front of me. However, in the interest of time, I would like to have Paula begin her presentation to you. And you have a mic in front of you, and it should be live. And please, everyone, welcome Paula D. Perlman.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you to the planning committee and to Donna and Mr. Lozano. Is he here?
Yes,
Devian. Thank you for all your emails. Sure. Really appreciate it. We have an exhibitor table out in one of those wine-named rooms. And we have a young volunteer who is also blind, who's sitting at a table for us today, Jonathan. He's a really good guy. He comes in the offices. So I am the executive director of the Disability Rights Legal Center, and I never talk sitting down. So I'm sitting here going, how can I stand up and talk? But I'm going to just try. The other, I want to talk about trends that are affecting people who are blind or have other vision impairments, and the disability community in general. It's about where we are today and where I think we're going to go, and how all of us can be a part of really enhancing the rights of people with disabilities. So the Disability Rights Legal Center is the oldest cross-disability organization agency in the country. We're 36 years old. And we started with it was a dream of one of our founders, A. Milton Miller, who was a lawyer in Los Angeles who had polio. And he was the guy people would go to if they couldn't get into the courthouse, if they couldn't get into a restaurant, if they couldn't keep their job. And he passed away quite unexpectedly, and his friends all got together, and they created something that was then called the Western Law Center for the Handicapped. And then actually, many of you know Marilyn Hawley, who's now at Disability Rights California, and Marilyn was our first attorney. And she hired Catherine Blakemore, who is now the executive director of Disability Rights California. And Catherine was married with two young kids and needed a regular paycheck. And it was kind of intermittent in the early days of the Disability Rights Legal Center. So she ended up being asked to start protection and advocacy. So we have this, I feel like I stand in the footsteps of these amazing leaders who have been instrumental in changing the civil rights of people with disabilities in California and across the nation. So it's a real privilege to be here. This is one of my favorite groups, too. I'm not supposed to have favorite groups, but this is one of my favorite groups. I must say, I was privileged to speak in Sparks, Nevada this summer. At the National Conference on the Blind. It was really, really fun. I'm not that bad that they have to start barking. Come on. I haven't started yet. Give me a chance. Really. So, and I belong to a synagogue in Los Angeles, and there's a guide dog in training there. And so I have watched this little puppy grow into this almost, she's like 14 months now. And they say they're lenient with her. So she's got so they're improving. Oh, here's Council Member Tom Labonge. I think we should give him the floor. Yeah, it's fine.
Good afternoon to everybody. How is everybody doing? The most important thing in our lives is when we get up each day to take a step forward to make a difference in the lives of not only ourselves but others. And you do that every day. Give yourselves a big hand. Donna, good to see Donna. Donna called me yesterday. You know Donna and Mitch Pomerantz, right? Okay, so Donna called me and told me, okay, you're out here. And I said, I got to come. But I want to let you know I really wanted to see Scotch, the doggy that they have right there. He's upstairs watching Larry King. Okay, so which is good. But every day is special. Each of us have challenges from everywhere we come. But you're exceeding the challenges. You're trying to help and advocate for those who are disabled, those who have challenges that others don't have. So I just wanted to thank you on behalf of Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, the Los Angeles City Council, and myself personally. But I will tell you, and I just got to say, Donna, your husband has been now retired, but was a great advocate every day for the community of Southern California and Los Angeles. Give Mitch a big hand again. Now, this morning I was at Third Street School, which is in the Wilshire area, and it was Cultural Day. And I didn't know they wanted to give me a special commendation for my work for the school, which was a big treat. So I go in there, the kids are cheering, and they're cheering me like I'm somebody, which was really very inspiring. Then they have a parade of children because it's Cultural Day, and they're each in everyone's native dress. Okay. And then I said, including, it wasn't necessarily, but they were representing the United States as they were dressed. This is the question now, so use your imagination. So they all came out with all their dress on, and the one who represented the United States, I said, guess whose birthday it is today? And I brought her right in front, and there she was, dressed as the most symbolic individual, but it never really was an individual. But do we have the answer right here? Statue of Liberty right here. What's your name? Peggy. Give Peggy a big hand. She got it first. I asked the fifth grade class, okay, whose birthday it is today? And they were frozen. Then I went to the fourth grade class, and they said Statue of Liberty. And the Statue of Liberty. Now, I got to ask this technical question. Do you remember Avak from the CLA's office, Mitch?
Yes.
Okay, I got to ask this question. Anybody here from Armenia? Okay, oh, you're close? Okay. From that area. Good, just to let you know, because he made me say this on council floor, that the medal for the Statue of Liberty comes from Armenia. So he had to, everybody has a pitch. So let's hear it for Avak. Okay. So I just wanted to come out and say hello. I haven't seen you in a while. Good to see you. Thank you so much. I appreciate what you do. And it's getting your voice heard. Just like these Occupy, you've already occupied. Okay? You've already occupied. And you became a department, which you fought to save. Give yourself a hand for that. So now that you have already occupied and you have a department, now you've got to articulate. And as you articulate, then you'll be successful in many things. Not all things, because you know why. Anybody, and I forgive me, this is a tough question, but anybody ever listened to the Gone with the Wind movie? Anybody? All right, okay, good, okay. So in the movie, what's the most important line? Anybody remember that one? Okay, all of you get a bad grade. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That is not it. All right. The best line is at the end of the movie. After all, tomorrow is another day. Okay. I love you all. We'll see you. Thank you. Have a great conference. Thank you, Donna.
All right. Give him another welcome round of applause. Thank you, Councilman LaVange. As he says goodbye to everybody in the room with the most warmth in the whole city. That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Uh-oh, one more thing. See, I knew it.
So sweet. Oh, no, you're not, Mitch, because you're special. If my dreams could all come true, darling, this I know, happiness will follow you everywhere you go. Everybody, love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfilled for my darling. I love Mitch and Donna and all of you, and I always will. Thank you, Donna.
Okay.
What a character.
We love him. All right. Everybody continue to please give your attention to Paula Perlman.
Oh, boy.
Thank you. What an act to follow.
Yeah. You don't want to hear me sing, really. Okay, so I want to cover a few things. Also, I want to leave time for questions and answers about things that you might be interested in as well, Donna. It's almost 2 o'clock. When do I have to stop?
No, actually, we're going to extend it just a bit. And so if you can, 240, 245, depending on how that goes.
So that we'll try, and I'd like to leave room for questions. Are there questions that people have right now that if they, that's, they're ruminating about and they want to know the answer to? And if you want to let me know in advance, I'll see if I'm going to integrate those into my remarks. Otherwise, I can make sure I cover those in the Q&A. Anything?
Let's go ahead and continue with your presentation. Yeah. And believe me, our group is not shy.
Okay. So I wanted to talk about some really recent victories, things that we should all feel really proud of. The U.S. Supreme Court, well, first of all, I'm a lawyer. So if I talk like a lawyer and you don't understand, wave your arms at me or say something, and I will I'll try and say it in a way that everybody can understand. Because sometimes lawyers think they forget how to talk to real people sometimes. So I try not to, though. But the United States Supreme Court, the highest court in the country, in the land, just announced that they would not hear a case. And why is not accepting a case for review so important? It's because the case that they were considering to take under review was such a good decision for people with disabilities, especially people who are blind, that we didn't want them to mess it up. So, and they didn't. So there, we have a wonderful victory in this case against the National Council of Bar Examiners versus NYART. Or it's NYART versus NCBE, but when it was at the U.S. going to the U.S. Supreme Court, the bar examiners appealed the decision. And so in the Ninth Circuit, which is in the circuit, the whole United States is divided into sections called circuits, and we're in the Ninth Circuit. And this is the circuit where the Supreme Court overturns, 90% of their cases. So we were all holding our breath saying, don't take this case. This one's good. But the U.S. Department of Justice developed a regulation for high-stakes testing. And the regulation says that test takers on exams like the multi-state bar exam and the MCATs and other those kinds of high-stake testing that lets you into getting a license or lets you get into graduate school and higher education, those tests have to be administered so as to, and this is the, these are the operative words, best ensure that the test taker, that the results of the exam reflect what the test is designed to measure rather than measure the test taker's disabilities. So the bar, it's good. It's amazing results. So the test has to, it has to be administered to best ensure the results of the exam reflect what it's designed to measure. So if it's for the multi-state bar exam, it's supposed to measure your knowledge in six core areas: contracts, torts, real estate, criminal law, civil procedure. Say it again. I know, me too. I'm like going, I just blanked. Ah! And I'll think of it in a second. I've been a lawyer for so long, I haven't taken the multi-state exam for more than almost 30 years. So torts, it's crim law, crim procedure, property, torts, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and contract. Thank you. So those are the six subjects, and these are like general principles of the law that are required in every state. Nothing specific to the state in which you live. And Stephanie, who used to be a law clerk for the Disability Rights Legal Center, graduated from UCLA Law School. She has a progressive degenerative disease that causes her vision to diminish over time. So what she had as an undergrad, an accommodation that she had as an undergraduate, is not the same accommodation that she had in law school, and it's not the same accommodation that, and it, finally, her last semester in law school are the accommodations that she needed on this multi-state exam. And they wouldn't let her use her computer. They wouldn't let her use the JAWS reader. They wouldn't let her use all the technology that she's used to using to be successful in law school. They wouldn't let her use. So they were concerned about security. So she said, I'll give you a bond. I'll pay $5,000. You use your laptop. You load your, you know, software onto your laptop. I'll use your laptop. You keep it. I'll never have copy of it. It'll never leave, you know, it's yours. And that wasn't good enough. So, I mean, it was pretty, it was unreasonable. And what the national, the NCBE, the multi-state bar examiners were concerned, said, you know, what they asked for, what Stephanie's asking for, her last name's Enyart, E-N-Y-A-R-T. So you might hear about the Enyart case, but it, I know her as Stephanie. So Stephanie's case was all about the test, trying to make sure that these high-stake testing agencies like NCBE administer the test to best ensure the results of the exam, test her knowledge about contracts, torts, property, not anything about her disability. This software is better, this is not. She won in the Ninth Circuit, and they appealed that decision. They said her requested accommodation wasn't reasonable, and because it wasn't reasonable, it wasn't a reasonable accommodation. We know that these high-stakes testing organizations and agencies are covered under Title III of the ADA. And so if you're covered under Title III of the ADA a place of public accommodation, including testing, because they have a physical location and they're administering these tests, they're covered, and they have to then engage in this interactive process to accommodate people with disabilities. And so private entities who are offering examinations have to provide appropriate auxiliary aids for persons with impaired sensory skills, unless they can show that that particular auxiliary aid would fundamentally alter the measurement of the skills or knowledge of the examination, or would it result in an undue burden. So it wasn't an undue burden. She said, here's $5,000. Go buy a brand new laptop. That's enough for the software. Pay the engineer to, you know, load it, and then give it back if there's some problem, if there's no problem. And her accommodation, she was saying, would best ensure, which is the Department of Justice regulation, it would best ensure that when the examination is administered, that the results would reflect her aptitude or achievement level, rather than reflect her impaired sensory skills. The court bought that argument. They gave a lot of deference, a lot of respect to the Department of Justice's regulations, and they issued a preliminary injunction mandating that they allow her to take the test. They appealed, and now they wouldn't take the test, which means the bar examiners appealed. The Supreme Court wouldn't hear the case, which means this Ninth Circuit case, at least in all the Western United States, this is the rule that must be followed. So it's very important for two things. One, it reinforces the Department of Justice's interpretation of best ensure for test taking as opposed to a regular reasonable accommodation standard. And two, it sets a precedent, because there are very limited cases in the subject area, that other courts and other agencies will need to follow. So it's a remarkable remarkable case, and I feel really privileged to know the lawyers that worked on it, Brown, Goldstein, and Levy, and disability rights advocates as well worked on the case. Okay, so that's high stakes testing. We're going to continue to see this as an issue. The LSAT test and the MCAT tests are also been challenged and will still continue to have challenges against those agencies. I was just appointed to the ABA Commission on People with Physical and Mental Disabilities, which just voted to change our name to Commission on Disability Rights Law, Disability Law. And the commission wrote a letter to the law school testing agencies, and they got the president of the state bar to sign on to this letter, and law professors and law schools and disability rights organizations all sent, a letter, several hundred signatures sent a letter to the state, to the LSAT, to that test. These are the entry tests to get into law school. So it's your verbal ability, it's your reasoning ability, and it's that hurdle that you have to jump over to get into law school. But if you take the law school bar exam, the law school entrance exam, with an accommodation, they don't add your score into everybody else's score. So you don't get a ranking. You get a score that says, here's your score, and you took it with an accommodation. Law schools, you do what you want to do with it, because they say it's not a validated score because they don't have a big enough sample, right? Right? You feel our offense. This is offensive to all of us. And so there's a huge move to eliminate this practice, because the accommodations under this new, not a new regulations, but the accommodation, the regulation provides that the test should best ensure the results reflect their ability and the measure of what they know. And as a result of that, those test scores should be ranked with everybody else's test scores so that you get in on your own merits. You don't get in on a pity vote. Well, let's do this, maybe. So what I think we're going to end up coming back to you with is, if you haven't signed on to those letters, but to sign on to those letters, and I notice you're training the next generation of leaders in this room, I see a lot of young people in the room today, which is really cool. We need to give a shout out to everybody under the age of 30 in the room. I see some hands waving. Yes, that's right. And look, I'm an older person. It doesn't mean that you can't have new ideas and you can't continue to grow. But you do have to train the next generation of rabble-rousers. You do have to train the next generation of advocate. And so the next time that we get invited to ask to speak, I'm going to bring one of our younger lawyers who should be speaking. I'll work with him or her to prepare. But they should have this opportunity to address the group so that as disability rights advocates that we're training the next generation as well. So I know it's my shout out to transition planning. I know, it's really important. So we're working on that, and so we'll come back to you with sign on to this. And maybe, we'd like to have Congress have hearings on this and things like that, so maybe we'll have an opportunity for some legislative activity as well. So it'll be good. The other thing that I want to talk to you about, so that's high-stakes testing. The other things I want to talk to you about is website accessibility, electronic books, service animals, and these relatively new regulations. So website accessibility, and then if I can, I want to do a very brief sort of highlight of some of the Disability Rights Legal Center cases that impact people with sensory impairments.
Can we please have quiet out in the
audience? I'll talk louder. Is that helpful? No? You still want quiet?
Either or. Yeah. We could do both.
Okay, I can talk a little louder. And you guys, shh. Oh, that was awful. So sorry. No. So let me talk to you about website accessibility. How many of you use the internet? How about this? How many of you don't use the internet? Okay, so wait, keep your hands up, if you would, please. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 people in the room. So clap if you do use the internet. Yeah. And so how many people would we say are in this room?
So go ahead and raise your hand.
Raise your hand.
So that Paula could.
If you use the internet.
And for all of you, I heard that out there. Mitch does use the internet.
13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 19, 20, 20.
For fantasy football, yes.
So at least 50 use the internet and 14 don't. 15 don't. So for some of you don't use the internet, you didn't grow up with it. For some of you, the technology is really expensive and you don't have access to it. But we do have public libraries and the libraries do have it. And we do have, you know, independent living centers and places that have internet available to you. And some of you don't use the internet because the websites aren't accessible. Right? And there's many, many government websites that are not accessible in the state of California. And some of them have pictures. They call them like JPEG files. They're just pictures, and you can't read them. You know, and you can't, it doesn't have text that you can, that's there. And it doesn't, so big deal if you send me an invitation in a JPEG. It's meaningless to us. Like, that's nice. That just took up a lot of space in my inbox. But it doesn't give me any useful information. And the Department of Justice about a year ago, July 26th, six months ago, published advance notice of proposed rulemaking to implement the ADA standards for accessible design. It's 2010, it's not 2011. It was a year ago. And they are considering, but we're expecting to hear from them shortly, about amending the regulations implementing Title II and Title III regarding websites. And so that public comment period closed, and now they're reviewing the comments. But in California, we don't have to wait. In California, we have Government Code Section 11135, which explicitly implements the requirements of Section 504 of the Rehab Act into state law. And so right now, every website in the state of California should be accessible, and especially government websites. They should be accessible. That's what Government Code 11135 means. But we know that's just not the case. So while the Department of Justice looks to, looks to these comments and things like that, and we know in California that we don't have to wait. We just don't have to wait. So we're looking at writing. So can I, by way of background, my background is I'm a lawyer, but I've been a litigator for over 25 years. And I love litigation. And I love litigation because litigation evens the playing field. It means that people who push you around and think that you don't have to do what the law requires you to do have to stop and reconsider that position when there's a lawyer on the other side of the table from them. And it's never just a lawyer. It's a lawyer and a client. It's a lawyer and people. It's a lawyer and people who have a stake in the outcome of that lawsuit. Because we speak, and so what we might not be able to do as one individual, we can do collectively. And a lawsuit is a very powerful tool. And the other powerful tool is to have internal allies. Because if you want to make real, real systemic change, the agency that you're suing or the agency that you're advocating with or against has to buy into it. Because when you go away, they're just going to go right back to what they did. When the 3 to 5 year monitoring period is over, if you don't have internal buy-in, then there's no real change that happens. And so it's litigation and friend-making. It gets you a seat at the table, but what really keeps you at the table is developing internal allies and friends who are there to help you do the work when you go away. And so we have some really, really very strong laws. And then we need to educate our state and local governments about what their obligations are. Now, there are other, the regulations will play a huge part in that. But we don't even have, what's so important is don't even have to wait for the regulations. The ADA was developed with the idea that, you know, despite the Department of Justice's, you know, historic resistance to entering the 21st century, the ADA covers websites and the internet. As early as 1996, the Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division recognized the need for the internet, stating, covered entities under the ADA are required to provide effective communication, regardless of whether they generally communicate through print media, audio media, or computerized media, such as the internet. Covered entities that use the internet for communications regarding their programs, goods, or services must be prepared for these accommodations through accessible means as well. That was a letter from Deval Patrick, then the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division, to the Honorable Tom Harkins, United States Senator. So we know, and also with the beginning of the ADA, when you look at the legislative history, there's all this language about this is the floor, this is not the ceiling, that we anticipate that technology will make a difference in people's lives. And so the fact that websites are not accessible or the internet's not accessible is a true disservice, and it's worthy of more attention being paid to it through litigation and through advocacy. There's been a huge amount of advocacy with other agencies and with agencies, but I think there's still so much more to do. It should not take a lawsuit to get JAWS and Zoom text, right? It should not take a lawsuit for that. But, you know, but it does. And fortunately, there are people that will do it. You know, we've had a lot of victory in the Target case and others. California is really ahead of the curve. So there's a First Circuit case called Car Parts, which is, over 10 years old. And they were very clear in Car Parts, that's a New York area case, the East Coast case, that said for a place of public accommodation, you don't need an actual place. And so the internet would be covered. You don't need a nexus to a physical place. Then there's a district court case in Florida against Southwest Airlines, yet again Southwest Airlines, that said, well, you do need a nexus to a physical place. And right now the courts are grappling with that nexus requirement. So in California, disability rights advocates and on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind sued Target and also for Bruce Sexton, and the National Federation of the Blind of California, they sued Target. And Target was an easy target under California's, under the ADA, California UNRUS Act, and California Disabled Persons Act, because there was a nexus, right? There is a physical location. You can buy online or you can go in the store and buy in person as well. So that is still, the question is, what happens when you're only using the internet? For example, the way to get a right to sue letter through the Department of Fair Employment and Housing is only online. It's only online. That website has to be accessible, right? So, so if you guys like litigation, I'm always looking for a plaintiff to remedy important civil rights, because it sounds amusing and entertaining. It's really so discriminatory to exclude people solely on the basis of disability. And it's technology that's available, and it's technology that's affordable. There's no good reason not to have it. But it still persists. And it persists because there's a lack of enforcement. That's why it persists. And we don't fund enforcement, or it's not sexy to do enforcement. But we're working on it. Okay, and that's why the ADA and the UNRU Civil Rights Act and the California Disabled Persons Act provides for a private right of action so that individuals can bring lawsuits to vindicate these important rights. There's another case pending that we're counsel on. It's the VL v. Wagner case, which when, you know, the prior governor and a little bit this governor is, you know, balancing the budget on the backs of disabilities. Let's cut all of in-home supportive services, right? Because that will save a lot of money. The governor determined that they were going to terminate IHSS services to 130,000 people. 130,000. They just decided we're going to eliminate that. And that we filed a lawsuit along with our colleagues, and we won. And I know that's why people are still getting, well, we won a preliminary injunction. And now there's a case that was argued on the first day. You know, the Supreme Court meets the first Monday in October. And the first case of the first term, with the first time there were three women on the bench ever, including Justice Sotomayor, who has diabetes. The first case they heard was another case from California that would challenge that our case, this IHSS case, was put on hold depending on the outcome of this other case that's pending at the Supreme Court. So we don't have a final outcome for that. What else did I want to talk to you about? Books. We've been doing a lot of advocacy, us and other disability organizations, to ensure that iBooks keep the text to sound on and that they don't charge you to turn it on, including e-books, like including iBooks, the Kindle app, and Blio. So this has been a huge, huge effort of a big coalition of people, of organizations working on it. The other thing that we saw with the new ADA regulations that came out, not so new anymore, right? They've been effective for years, the on service animals. So I have a pet peeve about people bringing their little foo-foo dogs in their cases to go. And it's a Chanel bag. In a Chanel bag to go shopping. A purse pet. Is that it?
That's what I call them.
Oh, God. I have a real... these little dogs, I have a real pet peeve about it because I think it diminishes the importance of service animals. And so in California, according to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, I must tell you, we do have a very strong advocate for disability rights in California through the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, Phyllis Chang. Are you familiar with Phyllis? Do you know her? Well, Phyllis has a son with a disability, and Phyllis... But despite that, Phyllis is a civil libertarian. She just believes in justice, and she believes in fairness. And she has brought some first director's complaint on behalf of the department. You can do that. She, under her leadership, she was appointed by Schwarzenegger, and she so far has kept her job under Jerry Brown. But she filed the first director's complaint, which means on their own, she filed complaints against Loma Linda Hospital for disability discrimination, because they did these tests that did conducted electricity through your arms to see if you had the potential for carpal tunnel syndrome for people who are doing data entry, and she filed a complaint to stop that practice from happening. She did another thing with truck drivers. So she's very aggressive about vindicating the employment and housing rights of people with disabilities and people of color and other protected categories. We know that disability cuts across every category, race, ethnicity, language, gender. And she's very aggressive about it. So according to Phyllis, service animals in California are not limited to the ADA definition of a dog, of the new regulations of a dog or miniature horses. But they still have to be used for a purpose, right? You still, are they trained for a particular purpose, and what is that purpose? Are they providing an accommodation for you? So the little, what did you call him?
Purse pet.
Purse pet.
I call him purse pet. Sorry, I'm just obnoxious. I gotta be me. They're purse pets, okay?
So the purse, these little teeth, you know, those I think the service for everybody. Also, the rats on a shoulder, you know. Like, tell me what they do for you besides intimidate people away from you or gross people out, you know. Or the parrot that comes into the Santa Monica Public Library as an accommodation. So, yeah. Yeah, the person comes in with a parrot. So these are things that we need to do a better job about educating the broader community about. I see your hand. Let me take questions in a few minutes. Okay, let me just finish one other thing. The lady in the orange in the front. But we need to do a better job at educating people so that they understand that the need for an accommodation is a really serious thing, and it's not a joke, and it's not just there so you can don't have to leave your dog at home. The other hand, there are people with severe mental health conditions, and those what you may call comfort animals are really providing a reasonable accommodation for that person so they can go out in the world and be independent. In the same way that a service animal or service dog is working for people who are blind, those other service animals work for people who have PTSD, who have severe mental health conditions, who have who are pulling somebody who uses a wheelchair and assisting them in their activities of daily living. So I think that I think it behooves us to work across disabilities in order to do a better job at educating the public and populations and government entities and landlords about the need for service animals. So it's about 2:30. I just want to brag a little, okay? Because I'm not I am the executive director of the Disability Rights Legal Center, and I used to be the litigation director. But we have a really, really talented legal director, Shauna Parks. And Shauna and I work closely together, but Shauna's a really creative litigator as well. Mitch, you're supposed to nod.
You didn't see the cue up there, Paul.
Now, we don't always agree with, because we're a cross-disability organization, we won't take a position that we believe harms another disability group. So we won't take, we were offered a settlement in a case once where it was like, we'll take all the funding for physical accessibility changes and put it for the deaf and hard of hearing accommodations. It's like, no, you can't do that. You have to make the pie bigger. You can't just slice the pie smaller. And so we have a few cases that I feel that are really cutting edge cases. One is against the city and county of Los Angeles on emergency preparedness. And we actually won a motion for summary judgment against the city. The city in depositions, as much as we've tried to work with them, as much as Mitch and other people in the room have worked with them, the head of emergency, you know, planning admitted under deposition that people should be prepared to live in their homes for 2 weeks on their own and not count on city services. And that's not okay. That's not okay. Or that the Red Cross will work on it. Well, that's not okay either. So, and when you have deposition testimony, we actually filed a motion for summary judgment to the district court, which says essentially, here's all of our evidence on paper. Judge, there's no way that the city can win. Find a judgment for us, and let's work with them to plan for effective emergency preparedness for all people with disabilities. And so the court agreed with us, and now we're in the process of agreeing upon the experts. And then the city, to their credit, has been working with the Department of Justice, has been listening to their own Department on Disabilities, and has been working to develop something called an annex, which is the plan to the city's emergency preparedness plan. So the other thing, and the county separately is, we're finalizing a settlement agreement with the county. They came to the table right away and started amending their plan, and they hired an expert to amend their plan. And the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, filed a statement of interest in the case because it's one of the few, it's the only case right now, it's the second case right now on emergency preparedness. And it's a huge issue for this current administration, Department of Justice's plan. We have another really cool case called CC versus Cypress School District. And this is a case where we have a young man, a boy, who's 7 years old or five. Yeah, he's younger. He's starting kindergarten. He's 5 years old. He uses an autism service dog. And the school wouldn't let him take Eddie, his dog, into the school. A dog, trained dog, works with the family, just like your service animals. I mean, that level of training. And so it took a lawsuit for them to allow Eddie to go to school, and now Eddie is in school with the little boy. I know. And then we have a case. We filed a Department of Transportation case because you can't against on behalf of a person, Edward Williams, who's a frequent flyer of Southwest, and they wouldn't let him take his service animal because he didn't have documentation for his service animal. And this is an ongoing complaint. We filed it in August of this year under the Air Carrier Access Act. And Southwest filed an answer to our complaint and moved to dismiss it. And Southwest has the highest number of complaints made to the Department of Transportation related to service animals. They had 96 service animal-related complaints in 2010, which is over twice as many complaints received by Delta Airlines, which is the recipient of the second highest number of service animal-related complaints. And according to the Department of Transportation records, Southwest service animal-related complaints increased 50% between 2009 and 2010. And Southwest service animal-related DOT complaints increased over 240% since 2007. In 2007, they had 39 complaints, right? And now, this year, in last year, they had 96. From 39 to 96. Now, for example, though, they had 39 in 2007, but American Airlines had 18 in 2007. Delta had 15. Northwest had 7. And Continental and United only had 5 each. So what's Southwest doing? We don't know. So what?
Cheap fare so people will lower
That's exactly right. They're cheaper fares. People who are low income and people who work at nonprofits can afford them. And you can't get damages, but we want to see if we can try and get damages from Mr. Williams. And also, we want Southwest to fix this. You know, sometimes they do much better with physical disabilities, but I have, how many of you know Richard DeVilder, right? I see that hand in the back. So Richard had to hire a lawyer so that they would let him fly without a companion on Southwest Airlines, right? So we need to, there's a lot of more advocacy to be done there. And then I just have two other things I want to talk about, and then I want to answer any questions. You want to stop?
Yeah, we'll. If you wanted to take questions, we'll need, because it's 2:37, and before we go to questions, I have a question. I'll take personal privilege here.
Wait,
I
you like have to this. Wait. You have to wait. Okay. Willits is a sidewalk case that we have, and it's a class action in federal court. There's this other class action that covers curb cuts. How many of you were at that fairness hearing last week on the curb cut case? Anybody? No. The Disability Rights Legal Center, Disability Rights California, and many other organizations filed objections to this class action because it doesn't guarantee funding, doesn't get fixed sidewalks, and it's over a 30-year period without ensuring that they'll actually fix the curb cuts. And we have a sidewalk case as well, and it's these are sidewalks being all these obstructions. You know, they're really, really hard to walk, and if you have a visual impairment, it makes it almost impossible to walk. And then our one other case, for those of you, how many of you have kids with special education needs or have had IEPs, things like that? Right? You've had your own IEPs and 504 plans. So we have a case against Riverside Unified School District because Riverside started this practice that in order to get services under an IEP, you have to agree to waive all your procedural safeguards. So, yeah, like, sure, you can get those services, but you waive your right for a year to do anything. How's that? Sounds unconscionable, doesn't it? And so we have two cases, actually. Now, the district moved to dismiss the case, and now we're fighting it out in the courts. But they moved to dismiss, and the judge denied their motion to dismiss it. But they do it, of course, unrepresented parents. And they bring these pre-drafted one side of contracts, and they retroactively, meaning if they had a case before, and prospectively, if they have one going forward, they say, if you want the services, sign the settlement agreement. Kind of unusual, right? We don't like that. So that's sort of my, you know, what's happening in disability rights. Now, please take the chair's prerogative. Thank you.
Okay. I'm taking a moment of personal privilege to ask a question. It was very interesting to hear the discussion on the city and county and emergency preparedness. This organization, several conventions ago, passed a resolution that was unanimously supported by the whole body. So it was not a resolution that was a Jean Lozano or a Donna Pomerantz. It was a resolution from the entire organization of the California Council of the Blind. That resolution came forward as a result of emergency preparedness in the county of Los Angeles and the lack thereof and lack of access for people who are blind and visually impaired. My concern, and we have spoken about this, but I never heard a resolution, no pun intended. but my concern is that, to my knowledge, the county of Los Angeles still believes that it does not need to make its tool, and yes, people in the disability community have told me that Well, it's just a tool. It's one of many tools. But the disability registry systems, and from the very beginning, and yes, sweetheart, I am a one-note samba.
Yes, you are.
Yes, I am. From the very beginning, the California Council of the Blind has gone on record, and the Metz family was also a part of some of the exercises that we've done. Melissa Hudson has also worked on some of these issues. But we have gone on record on the very beginning that any web environment, assistive technology, disability registries, anything that is information and access through the web, through the internet, must be fully accessible, not partially accessible, but fully accessible for people who are blind and visually impaired.
Absolutely.
And the County of Los Angeles has had told me directly when there was something on the first page that was extremely important, where you verify that the address that's on this map, which in the very beginning we stated that this mapping system is not going to be accessible the way they're doing, and we also gave the solution. So not only did we identify the problem, but we gave the solution. And before you continue, and I hope that either this tool will be sent away or it is being fixed or will be part of that settlement. In the beginning, when it says, please verify your address. Now, people, those who know L.A. know that there are probably, I'll give a perfect example, there are probably, I don't know how many 419 East Broadways in the county of Los Angeles. And on this environment, it states, look at the map. You know, you have to look at the map and verify that your address is correct so that if there's an emergency and you as a person with a disability registers, we'll know where to come get you. Well, how many 419 East Broadways are there in the county of Los Angeles? Probably very many. So it is my hope, and I don't know if you can update on this at all because you did say that you know, you're still in settlements, and I hope that based on our previous conversations and what I'm stating right now, that this is part of what will be mandatory, because I also know that there are attempts to do cases like this in other places and in other states, and our issues must be there too.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. If disability registries are going to be a tool, from the building of the environment, that full environment must be completely and fully accessible to those who are blind and visually impaired, who use screen readers, and those who use voice recognition software. It's imperative. So I hope that you build that into your cases, and I hope that you're having those discussions with those people behind closed doors as we speak when you're negotiating settlements.
Well, Len, I really appreciate that question. And here's the power of a class action. You put out the notice of settlement approval. Unless with the city we won, so there's no notice. We have a judgment. They have to implement it. With the county, it's still an ongoing thing. And in order to resolve a class action, you have to get the court's approval. And that means you put out the settlement agreement, and then you get public comments and objections. And so yes, we have talked, because I can't put my name on something that's not going to be accessible, right? I mean, Donna checks the Disability Rights Legal Center's website for us all the time. You know, she's our consultant, or she's my, you know, she's a friend. And Donna, will this work? You know, because there's no way that we can perpetuate discrimination by that level of inaccessibility. So I don't have the answer. I did text and email. But I'll tell you what, I promise you I will get back to you, and you can report it.
Absolutely.
Okay? If it's not, I mean, everything will be public because it is a class action. And there will be nothing that, it has to be 100% transparent. Okay? Okay. So the woman in the second row, yes, you had a question.
Yeah. And Ed will bring a mic to you, and that will be the only question. Paula, we will give you the
really?
Resolution as well. Yeah, because it's already.
I'm sorry.
47.
Okay.
So.
Quick question was the, you were talking about service animals?
Yes.
And you had mentioned that, you know, the new wording didn't apply, or maybe I misunderstood, to California.
Well, that's what, according to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, who enforces the Under Civil Rights Act and the Disabled Persons Act, Phyllis Chang, she believes that the new ADA regulations are too restrictive and do not apply to the definition of disability and to reasonable accommodations that we have under California law. So, yes, that's true. That's what I said.
Okay, okay. So it's not the same here in California.
It's not the same here in California. So it's broader, exactly. It's broader. So you can have...
So we can still have the reptile around the neck walking around.
If it is an accommodation for a disability. You can have a no pets policy. Is it trained to provide a service to the person with a disability? And there's permissible questioning that you can do.
Sure.
Okay? You can ask that. You don't have to tell me your disability.
Right.
You can
right.
ask, what's the is this a service animal? What is it trained to do? What service is this animal trained to provide to you? Hmm. And those are permissible questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
well,
you. Oh,
Donna,
go
will
ahead,
you give
Paula.
People like my email address or I can give it to you
actually,
if you have questions?
Actually, if folks can take Paula's email address, I'm going to have her give it right now. And Paula is very, very responsive. She answers email. It's wonderful.
I do answer.
So please take down Paula's email. I'm not sure if you're, you know, going to be able to stay around for a little while after or if you're going to need to leave, but please take her email. Paula, what's your email?
My email is Paula, P-A-U-L-A, dot Pearlman, P-E-A-R-L-M-A-N, a pearl and a man, Pearlman, at L... The letter L, L-S, L-L-S dot E-D-U. L-L-S stands for Loyola Law School. So it's paula.pearlman at L-L-S dot E-D-U. My phone number is 213-736-8362 and or 736-8195. I'm not as great on the phone, okay? Just so you know. But I have some cards. There's Braille. They're Brailled. I don't have enough for everybody in the room, but I'll leave them up here. And then Donna, if you want to, in your phone, in your newsletter, if you want to send them out. When's your break? When's your next break?
Our break is at 4:00.
I have to be back in my office, but you can email and call with questions, and we're happy to come back and do other trainings.
And Paula is very responsive, so please feel free to contact her. She is a friend, and as she said earlier, we can, you know, agree sometimes and disagree, but it's all friendly, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Respectful.
We're very respectful of each other, and Paula does great work.
Thank
so
you.
Everyone, thank you. Wish her very thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And I will be, and Paula said she's going to get back with the answer to me, so I'll go ahead and let all of you know. Can we have a door prize? I heard Louie. Ted, you've been delayed for just a sec. Ted is going to draw the name for the door prize.
Something like cash, candy.
We have some candy. And some $25 in cash. Now, if you see Louis Herrera's name, Ted, that you pull out,
uh-oh.
Put it back in. Don't give
uh-oh.
It to him.
Honest. That was an honest mistake. Sorry.
It's me.
Okay.
You know what? I'm really lucky right now. Let's do one more. Maybe Mitch will get it, and then I'll have two. Let's have Ted pull one more name. One more name. Remember? Keep it in the family, yeah. Remember if you pick Louis Herrera's name? All right. What are we getting here? What's the prize? We have candy, and we have $25 from Silicon Valley Chapter. Now, you have to be in the room. Is Don Brown here? He's not. Pick another name. Don, you missed money and food. Joseph Lopez, are you in the room? Joseph! Yay! Great. Louis, thank you for getting me money. Because Louis yelled door prize, so. Wow. Oh. Okay. The next item on our agenda is updating programs and services, highlighting the rollout of Braille billing. And our presenter is Ted Humphreys, Southern California Gas Senior Outreach Advisor for Customer Service. Ted, thank you. Give him a welcome.
Thank you, Donna. Is this mic on? Yes. I feel bad because you've had some very dynamic speakers in front of me, and I'll try to do my best. I'm with Southern California Gas, and there's a couple of things that I want to share with you and talk to you about and discuss with you. I think Paula gave such a very interesting and informative talk on litigation, and so I'm not a lawyer. I think I want to pick up on the second part that Paula spoke about. She said litigation, but she also talked about friend making. And I think the perspective I take is that litigation, again, not speaking as an attorney, so follow your legal prerogatives, but is always going to be after the fact. And also I think one of the other limitations of litigation is I've always felt one of the greatest forms of subversion or the greatest forms of disobedience is to follow the letter of the law. I think we want to get beyond that. And so that's why I've always found that I get smarter when I work with people like Louis Herrera and your president, Donna, because it's one thing for a website to be legally accessible. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised, Don, if the county's website that had that glitch that you pointed out, if you ran an accessibility test, it might be, quote-unquote, legally accessible. But the issue is whether or not it truly is accessible. And that's why we always want to embrace getting real users to help us. I will tell you that I have become a better writer by writing emails to Donna and to Louis, because I'm would be considered Louis calls me a mouser. I'm one of those people who uses a mouse, and mousers, I mean, are nice people. Really, many of us are, but we have certain limitations in the way that we write, and mousers write in a very sloppy manner. Mousers assume that the other reader is another mouser and can just glance at everything and sort of get the big picture. What I have learned from working with the non-mouser community who have taught me to write better, to write more clearly. And this is how I think in our legal system we might have taken an unnecessary turn, but I understand how we got there. But I never view accessibility as being an accommodation. Now, remember, I'm not talking as a lawyer. I view it just as intelligence and good design. And one of my other hats, you know, is a teacher, and we've been taking these courses called Universal Design. And I like that approach. That approach is saying, no, we're not just designing for this particular niche just because we're nice people. No, we're designing because we want it to be right and we want it to be good. And so So the question is, how do we get there? Now, one point is to have constructive feedback. Okay. And I think that's already come up in this room. Now, I used to be the webmaster of the gas company, and you get all the comments, and there are the people who just say, this website, and I can't say the words in public. That might be true, but it doesn't help us. Okay? But what we do want is constructive assistance. When Donna said there was a problem with LA County's website, and we have the solution. See, I think that helps us. And when I would have, you know, one of our employees is blind, got wounded in Iraq, and he will tell me, Ted, this is what's wrong with this page, and then we start working through a solution. So we're all humans. None of us, going back, maybe we had bad experiences in school. We always hate to be scolded. Okay, but if we can learn how can we make it better, then I think the end result is a better website for everyone, and that would be everyone. Okay. Now, what are some of the things that we are doing on our website? Number one, I noticed that many in the room are web users. And so we have an ongoing commitment to make the website accessible and the billing component of it accessible. I think it is legally accessible, but I think we also want to have a higher bar, which is ongoing feedback. If there's a particular page that's not working, if there's a particular function that's not working, that's where our community comes in. The other thing that we're working on and are rolling out and already have available is that we have a Braille bill. And we have Braille and Braille notices. Just as an idea, how many members of this room are, you know, fans of Braille, Braille users? Okay. Well, I will leave with Donna. I have about 50 books that the gas company has published in Braille on our customer service programs. And retrofitting is always a hassle. So what we're trying to do is just build this into the process. It's 2011, 2012. I have my new publications I'm doing. And now I know that this is the way I do it. I have my English version, my Spanish version, my large font version, and my Braille version. And we just build that in to the original run. So if we do things after the fact, you know, I'll be honest, maybe this isn't the answer you want to hear, but it's always a pain when you do something after the fact because it's like, oh my gosh, that's another thing that I screwed up. That's another thing I have to fix. It's another thing I did wrong. But if we get into the habit of just doing things at the beginning and just know, anytime we have a customer assistance publication, we'll have the English, we'll have some of the foreign languages, and I just have told my communication advisors, let's always allocate another run in Braille and another one in large font. So that's how we want to go moving forward. But if you want a Braille bill, all you have to do is call up the gas company and just say you want a Braille bill. Now, that will also lead to one other thing, and I don't want to be indelicate, so I apologize for this. But if you read Braille or visually impaired, and we want to shut off your gas, and we just leave a little card on your door, I don't think that's very helpful. So one of the advantages is if we know that you're getting a Braille bill, and I'm not saying any of us want to be at the situation of a shutoff, but if we do get to that point, at least the company knows, hey, don't just leave the card on the door, play Ding Dong Ditch, and leave. Because that doesn't help you. But work with us on this. We have to know that you want the Braille bill. So this is how we work together. If you let us know that you want the Braille bill, we can start mailing you the Braille bill. We can also mail you the notice in Braille. And God forbid, if you ever got into a situation where you were having some problems paying your bill, we would know. Don't just leave a card on the bill. So this is the situation where Paul is saying, the friend making and the collaboration and the work towards solutions. So we are already have the real bill. If you want that, call us tonight. Wait till Monday. Call us on Monday. We will start mailing you the Braille bill. Now, there's another thing that Donna challenged me on, and I'll admit, we aren't there yet, but don't worry, it's always being discussed, and that's large font bills and large font publications. We are working on it. We aren't there yet on the large font bill. I will say, though, that in terms of publications and information, we're starting to get that consciousness where whatever we have, we also put in large font. I know that's not as fast as everyone would like, but I'm just telling you we're committed and we're doing it, and it's now our way of doing business. On one final note, if you are income qualified, we want you to know that information is available on our website, and also information is available in these Braille packets on our customer assistance programs. Some of you might be on our rate discount, which gives you a 20% decrease on your gas bill. It would be the same with Edison, similar with DWP. We also have a weatherization program for our low-income customers. And one final note, if you might have friends or know of people who have severe medical conditions that require you to keep the home warm, certain kinds of arthritis or any kind of condition or serious areas. In those cases, you are given an extra medical baseline allowance. That doesn't have to do with income. It just has to do with your medical condition. If you know anyone who might meet those conditions, let them know about our program. It's called the Medical Baseline Program, especially as winter arrives. Now, obviously, over the last couple months, heating has not been the number one priority, but we are entering the winter season. We definitely emphasize conservation. I'll admit, in my case, if I want to, save on bill, my wife will just say, you know what, put on an extra sweater, let the dog sleep on your feet. But I don't think that's an option for everyone, and that's why we have the medical baseline program. Not all of our customers have the same options. So I really appreciate the fact that you let me learn. Because I, as I said, I always get smarter every time I go to one of your chapter meetings, or every time I come here, or every time I work with one of your colleagues individually. I'm, very grateful and appreciative, and I want you to be in contact with us so that we can continue to get smarter. Really appreciate your time.
And what I would like to, we could take one question, but before we take that question, I would like to share with you that Ted and Louie worked together, and Ted was very instrumental in being part of the ability to provide the first time ever at a CCB convention technology committee training on Window Eyes that will be happening on Saturday. And Ted was very instrumental in getting funding for us so we could do that. So give him another hand for that.
And Donna, where do you want me to leave the Braille books?
You can leave the Braille books right up here with me.
Okay.
And okay, Ed has just informed me of that we have a table here.
I'll leave them with Ed.
That he'll go ahead and put them on. So let's take the question for Ted. And please identify yourself by name.
Hi, my name is Mary Lou Baracco, and I have a question regarding pay by phone. More like a complaint. One, there are two ways you can pay. One, you could pay it by phone, but there's a charge. But the other one is they send you a slip. You need to fill it out, and someone is there to fill it out for you, then you send it back with the bank routing number and information, and then you could pay it by phone. Well, why can't it be set up where, like DWP or credit cards, where you can enter the information over the phone with your routing number and information and do it that way? It just seems like you don't want people to pay by phone.
Two things. Number one, what's your name? Mary Lou, I want to thank you very much because even though that's not my area, I know the people who work in that area. So it's not as though this is just going to go off into the ether somewhere. But what I want to thank you for is that your constructive criticism did contain a solution in that you are telling me, if I'm correct, that the DWP system works for you. Okay. You know, because, again, maybe it's just because I'm lazy, and I apologize for that. But if there was just a question or a problem, I wouldn't necessarily know how to fix it. But by the way you've already framed the question, you've given us a running start. You know, why reinvent the wheel? If there is another vendor that's doing it right, at the very least, when I work it through my chain of command, I'm saying, Mary Lou is not asking for the impossible. If DWP can do it, one would think we could do it. So I just want to thank you. I mean, we're here to learn. But it's always nice if we can look at someone else's answers.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much again for all of your support and for coming. And I hope you'll stay around for a little bit longer or come back throughout the week and visit us. Again, thank you for being a part of our conference and convention.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, now, before we continue, and of course I'm not finding the document that I'm looking for. How about a door prize while I'm looking for the document? Except Ed probably ran away. Oh, he's ready. If we can have Luciana draw the name. Okay, then here we go. What is it?
It is Dorothy Coulter.
Dorothy Coulter, are you in the room? No, Dorothy. Oh, the prize. $25 from San Francisco chapter.
And some Glucerna mini snack bars
from Blind Students California. Donna Sanchez, are you in the room? Nope.
It may be at the floor.
Lee Morton, are you in the room? Okay. Okay. There she is. There she is. Okay. Now, before we go to our next speaker, and Ed's running away because I can't remember that room number, we have a change in where the AMC party and the hospitality will be located for the rest of the convention. We will be having events in a suite. The suite number is 1535, and that's where we are going to be having that AMC party and also the hospitalities. So, folks, tell your friends, if you go to Sonoma, you'll be very lonely. Okay. All righty. 1535. That's what I get for looking for other things. It will be much, much better doing it there. So, okay. Now, the next item on our program. There it is. Ah, that's the wrong one. Okay, my apologies. That's what I get for trying to look for the number. I should have just asked Ed in the beginning to tell me the number instead of hunting and searching. The next item on our program, we actually were due to have Joe Xavier and Tony Sauer come and present to us. However, Joe is not able to be with us today due to some
family things. He had a loss in his family, so family comes first. And we are very, very fortunate to have Luciana Profaca, who we are very, very familiar with. And she is here to present to us today on Joe's behalf, and I know we'll do a wonderful job, so please give her a warm and healthy welcome. Luciana.
Well, thank you, Donna, and thank you, Jean, and all of you for being here today. As Donna said, I'm Luciana Profaca. I am the Chief Deputy Director with the Department of Rehabilitation. Joe Xavier, as Donna said, was to speak. His aunt passed away, so he was attending her funeral today. And Tony Sauer, our director, sends his regards. The council member sang a song as he left earlier this afternoon, and he had a beautiful voice. I cannot claim that I have a beautiful voice, but I promise you that at the end of this session, you and I together will sing a song. So, and I see some of our staff in the front row over here. They're going to be backup. So they're going to definitely, so get ready, start clearing your voices. Together we will sing a song and we will do ourselves proud. And I do want to congratulate you first for bringing us all together so that we can educate one another, inform one another, renew old acquaintances, network. It's really an opportunity when people with a common mission come together to do good, to share ideas. So I just really commend you for taking your time, for spending your money to be here. This is really critical, important stuff. And I also want to thank you for letting me be a part of this. And let me tell you why. I started as a student intern in graduate school in a rehabilitation counseling program in 1971. So that gives you some idea of how old I am. I was 21 at the time. This was in 1971. And when I finished school in 1972 and got my master's degree, I was hired as a counselor with the Department of Rehabilitation. And I have spent the last 39 years of my life. Thank you. Joyfully serving. And I retired this past December. And I've returned as a retired annuitant until the new chief deputy is appointed, which should be any time now. We expect the governor to make that appointment relatively soon now. So this is probably one of my last official meetings. And I have to say it's bittersweet for those of you who maybe have retired, because as good as what that next chapter might be to sever the connections, the love for your profession, it's very difficult. And I can feel my own internal challenge. So I thank you for letting me be with you and for having allowed me to spend my last 40 years of my life in this wonderful and noble work. So thank you so very much. So Donna and Jean asked that we address at least the following four issues, and I will do that. But also I have just pages and pages of issues that I think might be of interest to you. I also want to address whatever questions you might have. So what I thought would be helpful is I'll start with responding to the four issues that Donna and Jean asked me to respond to. I'll then address some of the quick highlights around budget and hiring freeze and some of the challenges and changes within the department. And then I'll address whatever questions you have. And about 4 hours from now, I'll let the next speaker move forward. No, I'll honor the time commitment that I was given. So let me begin by just sharing a couple of really exciting things happening at the Department of Rehabilitation. First, let me ask, how many of you, if you wish to acknowledge in the audience, have received services at one point or another from the Department of Rehabilitation? Oh, I'm so happy to see that. A large number of you. Excellent, excellent. And I know that some of the stories that you have to tell are positive ones, and I know that some of the stories that you may have to share have been less than positive. And it's really my hope that as the years have moved forward, our department has moved forward as well, and that our services are more responsive to your needs. But what I will say is that up until right now, when I was a counselor in 1971, an intern, and the way we provide services has been very consistent. It's, you know, one counselor, one consumer working together and establishing eligibility, developing a plan, providing services. And what we've come to realize is that there may be a better way to do that. And what we have worked the last few years in developing is what we call the Vocational Rehabilitation Modernization, and it's a VR mod team approach. So instead of having you and your counselor working together, the team is a counselor who's a qualified rehabilitation professional who has a master's degree in rehabilitation counseling or a related field, a case services coordinator who's there to assist you as well, an office technician who's there to provide, you know, assistance to that staff, and an employment coordinator, all part of a team there available to assist you to achieve your goals and your objectives. And that effort is just now in its infancy stage. It started with a pilot team in every district. You may know that we have 14 districts throughout the state. One of those districts is Blindfield Services, and Blindfield Services has supervisory units throughout the state of California. And every one of those districts has a pilot team. And over the next 15 months, we'll be assessing the performance of those teams and the satisfaction that staff have, that you as consumers have about those teams, and tweak it as it becomes necessary. But we're really, really excited. And we look to you and your colleagues and your friends who are consumers of the department as we're moving through this process to voice your opinions, your inputs. We really want to hear from you how you think that's going, and we're very excited about that possibility. That's number one. Number two, I don't know how many of you have heard about the AWARE system. Our counselors have spent, and it's been a criticism that our staff have shared over the last, what would you say, staff in the front, at least 20 years. We've had what's called the field computer system, which has been very time intensive. And your counselors have wanted to spend more and more time with you, but they've been pulled away from you by having to work on that field computer system. And just in the last, since August, so what's that, just recently after 20 years, and it was all with federal dollars. No state dollars were done. It was an innovation and expansion grant. It took no dollars away from direct consumer services. There was a project to change that system to be much more efficient, effective, and it's now totally operational across the state of California. It came in $3,000 below budget. It was a $17 million project, $3,000 below budget, and only 2 weeks beyond the time that it was slated to begin. It's considered the model IT project in the state, and we're just so, so appreciative that this new system is in place. One of the major interests and commitments that we made, and it's not perfect yet, you know, we're working on fixing some of the issues that come up daily. We have something called an awareium. The project is AWARE, so an awareium that's working with our staff so that they can voice their concerns and have those issues resolved. But assistive technology issues, accessibility, I was so happy to hear Ms. Perlman earlier talk about the critical need for accessible information, whether it's web, whether it's technology. And it's really an issue that's critically important to the department. So we're very, very happy with that that new change. And I'm just so glad that I was around to see it happen. So that was the other thing that I wanted to share with you. Also new, and a lot of these opportunities came as a result of the ERA dollars, the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act dollars. How many of you have heard that term, know what I'm talking about? Several of you, many, many of you. And I'll talk a little bit about what the department did with the $62 million that we were given from the federal government to with the ERA dollars. But one of those was to develop a rehabilitation resource database that will all be available on our internet so that individuals who are looking for providers of services will have informed choice in the availability of providers. So that database is brand new. It's just being rolled out as we speak. So there's a tremendous excitement. So just a lot of change, a lot of excitement, and I'm hoping that all of those changes will positively impact your experiences and support you in achieving your goals. So some of the topics that I had been asked to talk about, as I said, one was the Orientation Center for the Blind. You know that the Orientation Center for the Blind is in Albany, California. It's the only residential program that the department supports in terms of our own facility. We do send consumers to other residential program, but that's the one that's operated by the department. How many of you have attended the Orientation Center for the Blind? Oh, a lot of you. How many attended about 95 years ago? Okay, just a few of you. Well, what you will know is that the Orientation Center for the Blind was built, when was that new location, 1963-ish? I recall 1963, some of the historians in the group. Well, with the ARA dollars, part of that $62 million, $7 million of those dollars were used to renovate, remodel, create infrastructure, make sure that it's earthquake-proof, change some of the dormitory space so that there's independent living opportunities, change one of those large, large rooms that had been the woodworking shop and computerize. I mean, it's just really state-of-the-art. And there will be that entire effort, $7 million, and all of what's so interesting about this, every one of those dollars, and we were only given those dollars about 2 years ago, they had to be expended by September 30th. Try to spend $62 million in a positive, productive way where there's accountability. There was almost daily reporting to the feds on how we're going to spend those dollars. And we are just so proud that $7 million of those dollars went to OCB and that there will be an open house probably, Tricia, in November. Is that what's being suggested? I think it was planned to be in October, but here we are at the end of October. It'll probably be in November. So those of you from Northern California, I really encourage you, if you're anywhere in the Bay Area, to take advantage and come and see our new Orientation Center for the Blind. So the question was, where is the administrator for the Orientation Center for the Blind? So that was a question that we wanted to address. And basically, there were about 25 people who applied for that position. Of that 25, only 8 individuals had any blindness-related experience. And it was really critically important and required that the administrator of OCB know something about blind services, but only 8 of the 25 had any blindness-related experience. And 8 met the MQs, minimum qualifications, for the staff services manager 2 classification. So we were really hoping in the interview process that at least one of those individuals would distinguish themselves and be qualified to serve in the role as the Orientation Center administrator. We were very grateful that Donna and Margie and others participated in the interview panel, interviewed all of the 8 candidates, I believe. 1 withdrew, 4 were advanced. And what's required is 4 years of blindness rehab experience, 2 of the 4 years in a supervisory capacity. It's necessary that you need to supervise staff because it's a major, major operation there. That somebody be proficient in Braille and that they have at least a 4-year degree. So after screening, the bottom line was there was not a candidate, I'm sorry to say, that met all of those qualifications that was deemed appropriate to move forward to assume that very, very important responsibility. There have now been 3 recruitments to fill that position, and what we can share with you is that even though it's been done in a very inclusive process, we were not able to find a suitable candidate, but we are moving forward to look at the specs again, look at the legislation again, and continue the effort to fill that position. Joe Xavier, it's one of his absolute top responsibilities and priorities to fill that position, but it continues to be vacant. Warren Hayes, who's one of our longtime administrators, continues to provide some relief services there. The good news is we just hired a new rehabilitation supervisor who herself is an individual who is blind. Her name is Ms. Gomez, Rosa Gomez, and there's tremendous excitement. I see applaud from some of our staff up here. Rosa is an outstanding, she was an outstanding counselor, and we just have very, very high hopes for her and is now a supervisor at OCB. So we did want to share with you, and we'll continue that effort. The second question had to do with homemaker services, and let me see if I can share with you how the department is structured. What is our mission? Our mission is to provide employment, independent living, and equality for individuals who are with disabilities in partnership with our stakeholders. And homemakers had been a very large percentage of the number of successful closures that came through our Blind Field Services program. And in recent years, probably the last 5 years or so, even though we have a tremendous commitment to homemaker services and we're continuing to provide homemaker services, there's a tremendous emphasis on employment services. And the reason for that is that employment assists individuals out of poverty. The bottom line is, I'll never forget that our director made some comments that his commitment is that any individual who wants to work has that opportunity. So we're really stressing and supporting that effort. However, we are providing homemaker services, and we provide homemaker services under the following circumstances: to prevent someone from becoming institutionalized, to allow a family member who otherwise would be unable to go to work to do so, to reduce an individual's reliance on benefits. Services include orientation and mobility, in-home and community training, including cooking, cleaning, household management, evaluation of equipment and assistive technology needs as appropriate, and pursuit of employment for those who wish it. So we are still providing significant numbers of homemaker services. And if there are questions later in the presentation about that, we can talk about it some more. Another issue that has raised its head in recent months has to do with our consumers who are college-bound. And we have large percentages of individuals who elect to go to college, and we strongly support their efforts to meet their vocational goals if those goals require college. The regulations are that we will provide services at the cost of a community college for the first 2 years, and then when the individual transfers to the public 4-year university, we'll provide support at that level, the cost of the 4-year public university, at the Cal State University level. And for those that require graduate school, we do that as well. If an individual gets into any university, say Stanford, Harvard, an Ivy League school, and even if they get in and we honor their choice to get in, we, in most circumstances, I mean, there are always exceptions. The services that we provide are extremely individualized. And there have been circumstances where the individual's needs could not be met at a junior college or in a four-year public institution. There have been rare instances where other decisions have been made. But for the broadest group of individuals, services are provided in that way. 2 years at the community college, the next 2 years at the level. If an individual chooses to go to the four-year public school straight out, if they happen to get into UC Santa Barbara, UCLA, and they could get services at the community college but elect to go to the four-year school, the department will still provide services, but at the cost that it would have cost at the community college level. So that is some clarification. It has been met with some concern, so I was asked to address that. Believe me when I say would love to be able to provide services to whatever university the individual happened to be capable and qualified to get into, whether or not that was one of our UC schools or a private school. But it has to do with dollars and cents. It has to do with the fact that we touch 115,000 consumers in any given year, and 75,000 of those individuals at any given time. And if we were sponsoring individuals at $55,000 a year at Stanford University, we would not have the resources to provide the services to the number of individuals that we do. So that's the situation with colleges. And then the last area that I was specifically asked to address by either Donna or Jean had to do with our blind advisory committee. The Blind Advisory Committee is one of seven mandatory advisory bodies to the Department of Rehabilitation. It was formalized under Senate Bill 105. It has a membership of 13 members. Two members represent the California Council of the Blind. At the present time, there are seven vacancies that either are vacant or will be vacant by the end of the year, so there is a recruitment in that effort. And that body is charged with advising the department on policy and programs serving blind and visually impaired individuals. All of our committees, and not only the Blind Advisory Committee, but we're really trying to move away from a process where we're just sharing information to a process where the committee is absolutely involved in providing direct guidance and support to the department around the development of policy. So we really look to our advisory bodies, and in this case, the BAC, to assist us in that way. So those were the four areas that I was specifically asked to discuss. I also wanted to share with you a little bit of information about budget and what the impact might be for some of you. You know that the budget was passed. It was passed by July 1st, which is unusual in state government, so we're grateful for that. We also know that within weeks of the budget being passed, it was already announced that there was a deficit of many, many million dollars, into the billions, actually. How the Department of Rehabilitation was impacted was less severely than some of our sister departments, and we're really grateful for that. One of the reasons for that is that if you know how we're funded, the majority of the funds that support our services, including our 1,880 staff and our $430 million a year budget, the majority of those dollars come from the federal government. They're matched with state dollars. This year, we had to take a reduction of $900,000. That's a lot of services. But it's even more severe that that $900,000, that was our general fund reduction. That means for all intents and purposes, we cannot bring down the federal dollars. That means we have about $3.5 million less in resources. In the scheme of things, it's doable for us. We can continue to provide services. But where the budget impacts have had the most severe impact on each of you and your constituencies has to do with all of the safety nets that we've relied upon, where there have been significant cuts. Ms. Perlman earlier talked about the in-home support service cuts that were proposed and have been made. Significant reductions. The colleges, for someone to get through a college right now in 4 years is very, very difficult. It's difficult to get classes. It's difficult to get the classes in the orders that you need them. So we're seeing that there's significant need out there, and the cuts in the state budget have been quite significant. But I can share with you, I talked earlier about the $62 million in ERA dollars. $7 million of those dollars went to the Orientation Center. We were able to, through our Business Enterprises Program, are there any of you in the audience representing, Joni's here, and anybody else representing Business Enterprises? We were able to put out 10 new rest stops. So some of our vendors were able to benefit from those new opportunities, and we're really excited about that. $20 million of those dollars went to our community rehabilitation programs, many of the programs that you represent or that you have received services from in the years benefited from those dollars. $20 million of the dollars went to our collaborative programs. So we were just really thrilled that we were, and we spent every single dollar of those $62 million. And every one of our reports have been extremely positive. We spent them with great care and with tremendous input from each of the stakeholders within our communities, voicing their needs and their interests. So there is a hiring freeze going on. Do any of you, you may be aware of that. To get any position filled requires an exemption to the governor's office. We have requested some of those exemptions. They've been very, very difficult. But what I can share with you, we got an exemption for the Orientation Center for the Blind administrator position. We got an exemption for four or five business enterprise consultants. We got an exemption for the engineer at the Orientation Center, for a cook at the Orientation Center, for 21 support service assistants. That is critical. Support service assistants are the individuals who will work with our staff who are blind or have other disabilities to assist them. That was an act of God, but we were able to get approval for those, and we'll be able to continue to fill them ongoingly. And we got approval to fill 47 counselor positions. So we're really thrilled about that. I do want to share with you, and this is really critically important, is that the state process to get on these hiring lists is difficult, except now there have been many changes in the last couple of years. For instance, right now our exam for rehabilitation counselors is online. Our exam for rehabilitation supervisors is online. Staff service manager, too, it's online. There are many opportunities, and I just encourage those of you who may have any interest in working in the public sector to kind of take a look at some of those opportunities that are online. Also, I don't know if you know, but that our president issued an executive order, President Obama issued an executive order demanding that 100,000 individuals with disabilities be hired within federal government in the next 5 years. So that is a major, major shift and commitment. Also, you may not know that there's an initiative within California. It's titled the CME, California Model Employer Initiative, so that California can be committed to bringing on individuals with disabilities into their workforce. A lot of initiatives going on right now around reasonable accommodation, making sure that every single hiring manager within state government knows what their responsibility is to provide reasonable accommodations to people with disabilities, to engage in interactive dialogue with individuals with disabilities to ensure that their needs are met. So just a lot of changes, and it's an exciting time to be in the Department of Rehabilitation, even though the struggles of the economy that you read about every day in the newspaper are daunting. It's still an exciting time because we have a fabulous staff and a fabulous community that's here to support us. So with that, I can go on. I have like 7 or 8 additional pages. I have information on the Older Blind Program, Blind Field Services. Oh, what I can tell you, this is important, is the Department of Rehabilitation is required to meet certain standards to be able to get our federal grants. We need to pass standards. It means that people need to go to work. We need to get a certain number of people to work. All of these requirements. And I'm very honored to say that this year we passed our standards and indicators. So I really thank the staff within the Department of Rehabilitation. I can't tell you how committed and devoted and hardworking they are. So can I ask the staff from the Department of Rehabilitation who are here right now, could you raise your hand and stand up and let me applaud and bow to you? Natalie and Tricia are some of our excellent supervisors within Blind Field Services. Thank you so much for your hard work. Thank you. So I think, Donna, is this a good time to...
We'll take one question.
Okay, we'll take the question, but don't forget the song.
We'll take one question, and then we're going to have the song.
Okay.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Debbie Berry.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. And you didn't cover one thing, and I'm wondering if we can get some help. I work for the Department of Veterans Affairs Regional Office. I've been there for 32 years.
Yay.
And I'm basically kind of keeping myself busy. You know, their systems are very inaccessible. And apparently there are several of us that are blind that are really having difficulty. Is there there was supposed to be a contract for scripting, and it was were going to do scripting, and the lowest bidder there wasn't enough money, so there's no scripting, and I think that's a poor solution anyway. But do you have something like for job retention? And how we keep our jobs. Now, I was told by one of the, when I called the Voc Rehab one time, they said, well, you work for the federal government. That's their responsibility. Okay. Is that the way our rehab works?
Well, let me answer that question because it's critically important. But let me expand it beyond your issue. You're presenting an issue where you're saying, I work for the federal government, but my needs as a person with a disability are not being met. There is an obligation by the federal government, the state government, large employers, small employers, to meet the needs of people with disabilities. And as our attorney, Ms. Perlman, said earlier, I really encourage you to voice your needs, put them in writing, demand that you can do the essential functions of the job, but that you need that accommodation. And if the system does not work, they need to make sure that you can do your job. That's the best way I can say it. So if your question is, would the Department of Rehabilitation change the systems or provide the accommodations for the federal government, my response would be, contact the local office and work with them to help give you some information about how to advocate. But in terms of spending, the likelihood is spending state dollars to do that is very unlikely, because you are with a large employer whose responsibility is to accommodate your needs as a person with a disability. In the same way that the Department of Rehabilitation, and let me share this with you. We're very, very proud of this. We received an award the other week, within the last couple of weeks, and it was called an ACES Award. It's from the ACES is, it's ACSED, the Association of State Employees with Disabilities, California State Employees with Disabilities. And the award that we received was for having the largest number of individuals with disabilities on our staff, 26%. 26% of the staff of the Department of Rehabilitation are people with disabilities. And even a better number is that 24% of our new promotions are individuals with disabilities. So we're very, very grateful and proud to have received that award and to be acknowledged in that way. So with that, not to go over my time, I ask you to help me here because I don't have the voice that the council member had, but we are together going to sing one verse, and I'm going to start, and please join in right away, and I'm looking to Tricia and Nellie and the rest of you. Now, before we do this, though, I want you to just scream out, yay, as loud as you can. Yay! Thank you for that. Thank you for that. So here we go. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome today. Thank you very much. I had the wonderful experience last week. I was in Washington, D.C. visiting my niece, and I was able to go to the new memorial for Martin Luther King, and it was absolutely stunning to be there. So that is in honor of that new memorial. And thank you so much for being here and for allowing me to be with you and for being of service to you for so many years. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our last program item today is Sleep Light and Your Body Clock. Willie Hoos, Manager of Clinical Affairs, Vanda Pharmaceuticals, Incorporated, Rockville, Maryland, and Dr. Daniel Norman, Vanda Pharmaceuticals, Incorporated, Rockville, Maryland. And we will give the microphones over to them, and please give them a warm, warm welcome.
So this is Willie Hoos, and I recognize some of you in the audience from Reno and others that I've been at. And with me is Dr. Daniel Norman and Joe Martinez, and they're with St. John's Sleep Center here in LA and up in Santa Monica. So they're local here, and I'm in from Pittsburgh actually. So and I see Michael Garrett from Texas. Good to see you again. So what we're going to do is, so if I could raise a hands of how many have heard about the work that Vanda is doing. Yeah. So you know, definitely the vast majority in the room have raised their hand that have heard about it. And so as opposed to, I know we were here last year at CCB, and as opposed to trying to kind of repeat the same story that we maybe have told in the past, what I thought I'd do is I'd give you a little bit of a quick update to what's happening with the study side, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Norman for just a real quick refresher on what it is we're doing and what this sleep problem is, and then we'll keep that pretty short, 5 or no more than 10 minutes, and then take some questions and see, because what I would guess and hope is that there's some questions out in the audience that you may have, that you've heard about it, but haven't maybe done anything about it and had some questions for us while we're here. So if that format works, That's what we'll do. So I have three updates, and kind of one of them is a thing that I'll ask you to help us with. So the three updates are first, that the study is progressing pretty well, and we're getting close to the end of the recruiting for the study. And we hope to be done recruiting for the study by the end of the year, maybe just into the start of next year. So that's a really big accomplishment, you know, to find 100 totally blind that meet the criteria for being in the study and are willing to be in the study and do everything that takes to be in the study. We really appreciate that. So just that we're getting close is great, but part of that message is we're not quite there, so we definitely need help from you here as well as anybody you may know that isn't as connected with CCB. Let them know about the sleep disorder and the study. And one thing that I think can help with that is what my second item is in Matilda Ziegler magazine this month, and you may have seen this in California Connection. Matilda Ziegler magazine this month ran a 5-part series called Improving Sleep and Alertness of the Blind. And it was written by Lynn Lamberg, who's just a great science writer. It's written more very approachable, very newspaper-style writing. It's not a scientific journal article. So it tells a story. It interviews several people who have the problem, talks about what it's like, how they cope, what they've tried, talks a little bit about the scientific reasons and the cause. And it's all very readable, and it mentions the study as well. So that's a great read. It's a great thing to pass around the community. So I'd ask for your help in passing that around. And then the third is, you know, I've heard the talks about the state budgets and the others and the economy. We know is always a challenge. And there was a law that we became aware of that was passed last October. It was, you know, it was buried in one of the bills that goes through that political process that I don't fully understand. It provides for a $2,000 per year exemption for income that's earned in being part of a clinical trial for something related to a small disorder like this disorder, which is called an orphan indication. And so we've heard people say they're concerned about earning money in the study, which could jeopardize SSI eligibility or something like that. And so this bill actually excludes up to $2,000 from that, some of those restrictions. So if you'd heard anybody saying, yeah, but I can't earn any money or I can't be in the study because it would jeopardize something, that's another thing to keep in mind and learn a little more about that. And you know, you need to verify that it applies for exactly your situation if that was it. But that's something else that I just wanted to share in case someone hadn't heard about it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Norman. He'll just kind of cover a little bit about the sleep problem, and then we'll take questions for anyone that has questions to start thinking about those.
Thank you, Willie. This is Dr. Norman. I'm a sleep specialist here in Santa Monica at St. John's Medical Plaza Sleep Disorder Center. And I realize this is a review for some of you, so I'll try to make it brief. But for those that aren't aware of this disorder, quick background, everybody's got a circadian clock that is located in the brain and tells the body when it's time to eat, when it's time to sleep. It controls body temperature, it controls hormone levels, it makes you hungry at breakfast and for that late night snack. And it also helps regulate daytime alertness and nighttime sleepiness. Sometimes people feel like they want to take a nap, but if it's the wrong time of day, they're not able to fall asleep. Sometimes they want to be alert, but if it's the wrong time of day, they may feel drowsy. And for most people, that body clock is set slightly longer than 24 hours, not exactly at 24 hours. And so if they are left to their own devices without any external cues, meaning no light, no clock, no TV, they will resort to their natural body rhythm. And this was studied first in people with vision who were placed in controlled circumstances and caves and research rooms without any light, without any clocks, without any television. And they recognized that if left alone, most of these people would go to bed a little bit later each night and get up a little bit later every day. pretty soon they would be going to bed rather than going to bed at their normal time of, let's say, 10 or 11 p.m., they'd be going to bed at 11, 12, 1, 2, and they'd march their way around the clock, eventually come back to the start time. And what keeps most people from having this happen is that they have external cues, and the biggest cue is light and dark exposure. So when they get up in the morning, if they see a lot of bright sunlight, it resets their body clock. At night, when it gets dark, it helps set their body clock and stay on local time. However, for some people who have no conscious light perception, this cue is absent. And even though there are other cues, like the television, the computer, the clock, those cues aren't strong enough to keep them on local time. So some people who have no light perception start to have issues staying on local time and have difficulty falling asleep that progresses as the weeks wear on, or difficulty staying awake. And so these people are sometimes trying to go to bed at what should be normal bedtime, but having difficulty falling asleep, and then sometimes trying to stay alert while they're at work, in a social situation, at a lecture, and falling asleep, as some of you might be doing right now. And
I hear no
snoring. Thank you. This was a disorder that has been recognized to affect about half of people who have no conscious light perception. The other half, even though they don't consciously perceive light, may be able to still have the light exposure or reset their circadian clock, or they have a circadian rhythm that is within the same time wave of 24 hours or close enough that they don't get off track. There isn't any FDA-approved treatment for this, and some people have tried various things, melatonin being the most common, but not having any real data to support it. And this medication we are testing is a melatonin agonist. It works on some melatonin receptors in the brain. And we're looking to see if it can help these people who often have a lot of difficulty maintaining employment, staying awake and alert at parties and lectures, maybe not this one, and falling asleep at night. And it can be quite debilitating for people who suffer from this, as I'm sure some of you know. And we've been very fortunate to be involved in this study locally, and not so locally, as Vanda has been quite generous in helping arrange for transportation for people who come from far away, whether it's by private taxi, by train, and now even by airplane. We have some people flying from Northern California to Santa Monica to put up in a hotel, and they go through the screening process to see if they qualify. And if they qualify, they get reimbursed for their time and get enrolled in the study. And in this study, they go through a few phases. One is a qualification phase where we do some lab tests, check for other disorders, make sure that they meet criteria to qualify for the study. And then they go through a randomization phase where some of them will receive the actual study medication, some of them will receive a placebo. And we don't know which patients get the study medication, which one's the placebo. The patients who are enrolled in the study don't know whether they're getting the real medication or the placebo, to keep everybody honest and see how they do. And at the end of the study, they're going to look at all the data and hopefully find that this medication can help with this disorder and apply to the FDA to obtain approval to have the first actual FDA-approved medication for treatment of what has been a debilitating disorder for many people.
Looks like we have a couple questions, so I think we're going to walk around with the microphone. And
yes, Gene Lozano. I have the sleeping disorder since I lost my vision. Unfortunately, I didn't meet the criteria, and I assume it's because you have to have be under a certain weight amount, height and weight, a ratio. I guess it's two-part. Do you, assuming that your research finds that the medication you're looking at does work, do you see any restrictions then it will be on based on your physical makeup, height and weight? And the other thing is there part of this sleeping disorder, part of a motion sickness where you get into a car or some vehicle and you start slowly being rocked to sleep almost within minutes? I hope that's a thing, because that's the problem I've also found with my portion of sleep disorder, which drives my wife up the wall when we're driving somewhere.
So for the first part of your question, the study does have some criteria that restrict people to a certain body weight, or actually body mass index. This is pretty common for clinical studies because they are looking at dosing and want to restrict to people of a certain body size, and also exclude patients who may be more likely to suffer from other disorders that could affect the results. But once the study is completed, if things prove to be effective and successful, I anticipate that it would be quite likely open to people of all sizes and heights, weights. And we're looking at a broad range, 18 to 75. It's whether it would be approved for pediatric populations at a later date, maybe, but that would probably require another set of studies. With regard to the second question, people who suffer from various sleep disorders are often more apt to be drowsy during the daytime, especially if they're not sleeping well or adequately at night. And different situations are more likely to manifest the drowsiness. One is sitting passively in an environment where you're not really engaged in something. One is being on a plane, automobile, bus, and motion may play some role in, like you said, rocking people to sleep. If you've slept adequately at night, unlikely that you would fall asleep in such circumstances, but people who don't get enough quantity of sleep or quality of sleep are more at risk. And I see patients all the time who sometimes say, I don't have a sleep problem. I can fall asleep here. I can fall asleep there. I fall asleep on the bus. And they don't recognize that that's an indication of a sleep problem. Sometimes their family or friends do and say, it's really annoying because we never go to a movie, or if we go to a movie, it's a wasted ticket. And right now it's a very expensive ticket because he's asleep halfway into it. But that can certainly be a common manifestation. The other side is difficulty falling asleep at night, staying asleep at night, waking up too early. And so it's often two sides of the same coin. Yes.
I'm one of the victims that falls asleep in the car easily, too, but I had some vision until I was 23, and my name is Barry Powers, and I have, I think what they call phantom light 24/7, and it can mess up my sense of direction, and I guess it's like looking through fogs and clouds and things like that. I don't know if you've come across that. But I think I must have a sleep disorder. I can sleep okay at night. I wake up a lot, but I don't stay awake long, and I have my cell phone routine, but I am one of those victims who falls asleep in a car easily. So I just wanted to know if you've had anybody that has mentioned anything about, I've always called it phantom light because that's what the doctor called it for me.
I have met others who suffer from those symptoms, and if it is phantom light without actual light perception, it doesn't necessarily mean that you would be excluded from participation in this study. It sounds like you have issues with sleep that are troubling you greatly, and we'd have to talk in more detail personally to see if you meet other criteria to participate in this study.
But phantom lights, if it's not related to outside light, is still eligible in the study.
Correct.
Is that right? Okay.
Hi, my name is Nancy Unger, and I know a lot of people have sleep apnea, and I'm trying to get involved in the study. But does that have any bearing on the study about these? You know, does the sleep apnea have any bearing on the sleep-wake cycle for blind individuals?
Sleep apnea, for those who don't know, is a common disorder that is related to disrupted breathing during periods of sleep. It's more common in people who are overweight, but it can affect people of normal body weight as well. It's often associated with snoring, and it often affects sleep quality. So people may get enough hours of sleep or may not, but they don't get good quality sleep because their breathing is disrupted and so they're constantly arousing during the night. For the purposes of this study, if you have sleep apnea and it's treated, I don't think that would exclude you from participating in this study. The protocol leaves it up to the individual investigator to determine whether the non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder is the primary cause of the person's sleep issues or if there's another disorder. Certainly, if you've got a lot of sleep apnea and it's not being treated or not adequately treated, then we'd have to address that separately. But if you have sleep apnea and it's been treated and you're still having sleep issues, then certainly you could still participate if you met all the other criteria.
Let's hold on. No other hands.
Well, all right. Well, just one other comment. This is Willie Hoos again. We do have a table in the exhibit hall, and I'll be there for the rest of the afternoon and tomorrow morning if anyone has any further questions or wants to pick up any brochures. There is an 800 number you can call, or you can stop by and get any of that information that you need from me. Looks like there is another question.
Gene Lozano again. Sorry. I wanted to find, years ago I had read that the apparently within our skin, throughout our body, there is a certain percentage of rod and cone cells, and that I believe the Russians had found that, you know, if there's some time some people had a high density of those concentrating like in fingertips, and which gave them subliminally the ability to identify colors and things. I'm not going down that route. I was just wondering, if those cells do really exist within our skin, is there a possibility those could be registering some level of light that could regulate our inner clock, even though we do not have the light coming through our eyes?
There's a considerable amount of controversy about that. There's a study that comes to my mind where they administered light to the back of people's knees and saw some difference in how they responded that made people, scientists suspect that people had some sort of light receptor there. But later studies suggested maybe that was not the case. So I don't think that has really been worked out fully in detail, and I think maybe in years to come people will have a greater understanding in terms of whether receptors in the body other than in the retina can pick up these signals. Sometimes it's confounded because the light is also coming with heat, and whether it's the light or the heat that is causing some sort of signal. And I know that's one of the concerns that have been expressed with some of the studies that have been done looking at this.
Thank you.
We have one more question, and then that'll be all.
Question, yes, sir. Thanks. Barbara Reiter. And what I was wondering about this disorder, I wonder if the thyroid does play a role in this problem of sleep, because I know one of the symptoms of what's called hypothyroid is you can, like, inappropriately fall asleep during the day, or if you you work a swing shift like I did, it can happen this way where you're working and all of a sudden it's like you turn sort of mentally gray and sort of dopey or something, and there's a problem about the work. I know because it's happened to me working swing. If the thyroid has something to do with this disorder you're talking about?
That's probably two questions in one. The thyroid gland can affect sleep. People who are hypothyroid often end up being more tired and have difficulty staying awake during the day, but sometimes can have difficulty sleeping at night. People who are hyperthyroid may have difficulty falling asleep and be more alert than care to be. you also touched upon swing shift work. We're talking about non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder as a circadian rhythm disorder, but there's actually a separate disorder of shift work disorder. And people who work night shifts, rotating shifts, swing shifts, sometimes have a mismatch between their circadian clock and times they like to be sleeping or times they'd like to be alert. And another circadian rhythm disorder we sometimes deal with is jet lag. People who fly from one time zone to another, their circadian clock is on one time zone, local time's on a different, and they may also have difficulties falling asleep, staying awake. So there are a lot of different types of circadian rhythm disorders, and sometimes there can be more than one at play. But this study's particularly focused on non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder in people who don't have any conscious light perception.
Okay. Thank you so very much. And again, remember, they are in the exhibit hall, so go and visit if you have more questions. Thank you so much for being here today and presenting to us. And it looks like there are going to be some new things in the future, so stay tuned. And again, visit them in the exhibit hall.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, we are going to have a door prize, but again, for those who might not have heard the announcement, remember that the AMC party has moved, and it is in 1535, not in Sonoma. And Ed, if we can have Dr. Norman or Willie pull a name. $25 from Greater Los Angeles and a digital message recorder. Dirk Neihardt, are you in the room? Ah, he's probably in resolutions. Dirk Neihardt.
Laura Russell.
No? I bet we have delegates in the room right now, huh?
Doug Martin,
are you in the room? Melissa Hudson, are you in the room?
Yes.
Yay! Wonderful. Last announcement before we close. Jeff Tom, Resolutions Committee Chair, wants me to remind everyone, if they have any resolutions, you need to have them in tonight by the meeting of the Resolutions Committee. So, remember, resolutions are due tonight. Jeff said take them to them when they meet this evening. Thank you very, very much, and we will see you again very soon, probably at the party. Thank you.